Hello, testing, testing. Yeah, there we are.
Post your stuff somewhere where we can get at it.
Yes, it is being posted. In fact,
I'm not a student, so I don't have a password.
Okay. We're testing. We're on. Okay. Welcome back. This is lecture number 2. And before we start today, I'm going to start with a word of prayer because, quite frankly, we're going to need it. So if you all bow your heads. Our Heavenly Father, we consider it a great privilege to be able to come to the throne and ask questions and look at the evidence which you have given us to come up with the answers. However, we know this can be fraught with many difficulties, and so we pray earnestly that the Holy Spirit will be with us today. Guide our minds to truth, as you promised in John 16, and may we see truth and appreciate it and internalize it, we pray. Amen. Okay, last week, we set the stage, set the table, if you will. We looked at a number of Bible texts because, as I pointed out last week, science has nothing to say about sin and religion, sin and salvation. Only the Bible does. And so we had to get our parameters and our marching orders from that source. So most of last week was from the Bible, as it should have been. This week, it's going to be heavy in science. And I'm going to warn you in advance, this is the one lecture that, of all of them, might, to some of you, be too much science. And I hope that you'll just bear with me. We set the table last week in the Bible, and now we have to set the table in science. And that means we're going to be going over some concepts. And I'm going to try to make them as simple as I can, but they're basic concepts we're going to have to understand for the next 8 lectures, because they are going to tell us an awful lot about the topics we're looking at and how they interact. So stick with me today. I know it's going to have some definite scientific bent, but we can do it. We can get through it. And if I'm getting too far ahead of you, Put up your hand and say, slow down, and please give us a little further explanation, okay? Because I at times tend to go lickety-split when I shouldn't. Now, this is Introduction to Information Theory and the Information War. Richard Dawkins has an interesting quote. In The Blind Watchmaker, here's the quote. If you want to understand life, don't think about vibrant, throbbing gels and oozes. Think about information technology. Well, what's he saying in this sentence? Well, what Professor Dawkins is really saying is, if you want to look at the essence of life, you don't go and try to look at the cells. If I were to have put up here a slide of a rat neuron from the cerebral cortex, and a human neuron from the human cerebral cortex, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference if I didn't tell you which was which. They look the same. And I'm going to tell you, not only do they look the same, but they function the same. They have the same potassium-sodium pump that is responsible for carrying the electrical charge down that neuron. For all intents and purposes, if you look at that neuron, those two neurons should be, I said should be, I didn't say they are, I said they should be interchangeable from anything we can tell. So what Richard Dawkins is saying here is, if you go and you look at cells, even with electron microscopy, you're going to come away scratching your head, because mice look and act a lot different than human beings do. And yet if you looked at their liver cells, they look the same. You look at the neurons. They look the same. Look at the striated muscles. They look the same. Look at the myocardium. looks the same. There's something else going on here, and that something else is vitally important, and it's what's going to what we're going to be talking about all day today and for the rest of the 8 lectures, because it has to do with information and information theory. So what does Richard Dawkins mean by information technology? Well, this is from Scientific American, February 2002. It says, the essence of the universe is information. So this line of thinking goes, and the fundamental bits of information that give rise to the universe live on the Planck scale. And I'm going to define that for you here in a moment. You're going to see what we're talking about, because I want you to get a good grasp of where we're going. Information means distinction between things. I'm going to stop here for a second. If I were to ask you what information means, you'd all say, well, it means information. And if I drilled down and said, well, come on, let's be more specific, some of you might say, well, it tells you about things. But you'll find out very quickly you're going to run out of adjectives that tell us what this word means, because it is a word we all seem to understand in our gut, but it's hard to put into language. And what the scientists have done is they've put it into language, and not only language, but they've put it into binary code. So, back to explain, information means distinction between things, and this is an important definition, and that's why I stopped this here, because you're going to find out that Professor Leonard Susskind from Stanford University, Professor Emeritus of Physics and a Nobel Prize winner, and he happens to be the one that took on Stephen Hawking on this idea of black holes and won. So we're not talking you're just run-of-the-mill professor here. We're talking about someone who is an elite leader in the field. And he explained, I'm going to go back to the slide here, explained Leonard Susskind during a lecture at the New York University last summer. It's a very basic principle of physics, that distinctions never disappear. They might get scrambled up or mixed up, but they never go away. I'm sure most of you have heard the three laws of thermodynamics having to do with heat and entropy and things of that nature. And one of those rules says that energy is never lost. Energy may change from one form to another, but in the universe there's a set amount of energy. Guess what? The same is true for information, which we haven't fully defined yet. But information is just like energy. It's never lost. And some people argue it doesn't. Black holes, we're not going to go there, because there's pretty good evidence that that information is stored at the event horizon of the black hole as the particles go in. So information is not lost. Now, what I'm going to do now is I want to show you the size of a Planck scale. Because if I came up here and told you that a Planck scale is on 10 to the minus 35 meters, you would just sort of look at me with, so? And I want to get across to you how, what level we are going to be talking on, because guess what? I'm going to suggest to you in 3 lectures that this is the level that the Holy Spirit works on. So we need to get an idea. So just relax and watch. This is rather quick. It's going to take you from the Planck scale out to the universe and back. So just watch carefully as we go. about the intelligence that came up with that scope. Isaiah 40 tells us that he knows every one of the planets and every one of the stars and the approximately 100 billion galaxies, which have 1 to 300 billion stars per galaxy and have unknown amount of planets circling. But he also knows the hairs on your head. And he knows where all the quirks are and the up bays, and the up and the down quirks and the basons. He knows where all of them are. That's the scope we need to be looking at when we're going to be talking about sin and salvation. We tend to think about it as a bunch of do's and don'ts and someone up in heaven keeping a scorecard. I want you to get rid of that. We're talking about something much, much bigger. And why is there such a big spread between what the smallest and the largest is? Because the bigger the spread, the more the Creator can do. The more options that are open to Him. So, this is where the war is. Remember the title, Information Wars? This is where the war is. This is where we have to look. And that's what we're going to do today. Okay, finishing up on information theory. Information bits. Bit comes from binary digit. And it usually means, it's the scientists have defined it as one bit, one unit of information. And they are able to break everything down into bits, by the way. It's not a problem. Our fundamental building blocks of the universe. I believe that space-time is what we call emergence, says Hermann Verlinde, a physicist at Princeton University and a former student of Tehaft. It will come out as a bunch of zeros and ones. Now, I purposely put up a statement that's a little bit on the cutting edge because I want you to think. I want you to expand your horizons. What this is really saying here is that everything in this room can be broken down to ones and zeros. And in fact, it is. And that each minute of time is not continuous, that they're quantitized, which means they're segmented. So just like the old Super 8 movie that you used to watch that would give 8 frames per second, well, we're in a much faster frame per second, but we are in a frame per second. You can the frames are just moving very fast, and we see them as continuous. Time is not continuous. There's small quantum bits of it. Why all this chatter? Why am I bringing this up? This is Sabbath school, for goodness sake. It's not introductory to physics. Because I want to get across to you that everything is information. There is nothing that isn't information. And therefore, when we want to go talk about sin and salvation, we have to go through, put on our information theory glasses if we really want to make sense out of it, in my opinion. Energy and matter are merely the vehicles that carry information. Information is, if you have a pecking order, information's at the top of the heap. Energy and matter simply are the vehicles it uses to get around. There is no place in the universe that is information-free, and we could talk about out in deep space. It's teeming with information. All kinds of things are going on there. Even what was once thought to be a vacuum, it is not. And information provides the basis for everything, including the human body. The Leicester Press printed something this year where some students who were in graduate work there at the Leicester University, as one of their projects, decided to break down the human body into ones and zeros, information bits. And then they tried to determine how long it would take for them to transfer that information up to a platform circulating around the Earth, much like the space station. You remember the old Star Trek where they used to beam me up, Scotty, sort of thing? Well, that's what they wanted to see. How much information would have to be sent up, and how long would it take to send that information up for one human body? And they assumed a 30 gigahertz bandwidth and that it would go 24/7. Well, it would take approximately 14 billion years times 350,000. And their point was you could walk it many times over before you could send all the information up. So you and I can be described in ones and zeros. And people have actually done calculations on the human brain. You know, the human brain has 10 to the 15th connections. Trust me, that's a lot. But if you took the human brain and we were able to freeze it in time and then watch all of where the dendrites meet the axons, that's where they connect, and we were just to say at each one of those places where they meet, and there's 10 to the 15th of them, 1 times 10 to the 15th, if an electrical impulse went across that bridge, there's a 1. If the electrical impulse didn't go across that bridge in that minute, it would be a 0. In order to catalog your brain's activity for 1 minute, assuming you're awake, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say right now, but some of you may not hold true. I've already got you thoroughly confused. In 1 minute, in order for that to be documented, if let's say we're going to do a printout, we would need a book, a million pages long, and you would need 1 million of those books for 1 minute just to catalog the electrical activity in your brain. So consequently, we don't have to worry that someone's going to be reading our brains just yet, our thoughts. It's very complicated, and the amount of data is overwhelming. I've tried to give you a big scope of information theory, but now I'm going to have to get someone else to help me give it to you in a way that I think is much more understandable. And so I have a short video here, and I think this will give you a working definition of information. We're almost through with this. We're going to get on to genetics here in a moment. But I think it would be very helpful if we take a quick look at this.
For 4,000 years, writing was pretty much the only information technology people used. But in the 19th century, during the Great Industrial Revolution, things would begin to change. In the maelstrom of ideas and inventions, a series of seemingly unconnected technologies would emerge that all began to hint at the immense power of information. These technologies would all come from very practical, very untheoretical origins. But they would start to reveal that information was a much deeper and more powerful concept than anyone had realized. One of the first of a new breed of information technologies would be developed in the French city of Lyon at the end of the 18th century. Lyon was home to some of the best craftsmen in the world. It was also a place of great opulence, grandeur, and above all, money. Thanks to the rich and fashionable aristocrats and bankers who lived there, it would become home to the greatest silk weaving industry in the world. Almost a third of the city's inhabitants worked in the silk industry, and it was home to over 14,000 looms. This is brocade, the material that made Lyon famous. It's a beautiful and intricately woven fabric that, as you might imagine, is incredibly labor-intensive to produce. A two-man team working flat out for a day could at best produce about an inch of this amazing stuff.
The demand for the fine fabrics of Lyon was immense. But the silk weaving process was painfully slow. But thanks to a soldier and weaver named Joseph Marie Jacquard, a device would be developed to help speed up weaving. In the process, it would reveal a fundamental truth about information. Building on the work of a number of others, in 1804, Jacquard patented his invention. At the time, the loom was the most complex mechanism ever built by humankind. Jacquard's loom was a miracle of ingenuity. You see, he designed a single machine which, without any alteration to its construction, its hardware, to use a modern term, could be programmed to weave any pattern a designer could think up. In fact, it could produce a whole range of silk designs with barely a pause in production. Jacquard had found the holy grail of weaving, and his secret was a simple punched card. The punched card held within it the essence of the designs that the loom would weave. When these punched cards were fed into the loom, they would act to lower and lift the relevant threads, recreating the pattern in silk. Any design you could think of could be broken down and translated into a series of punch cards and could then be woven by the loom. Information was being translated from picture to punch card to the finished fabric.
It is a machine for weaving textiles, that's its task. But there is nothing specific about what textile it should weave. That is contained in the information which is encoded on the cards. So if you like, the cards program it, that is to say, instruct it what to do. And this has huge resonances for what came later.
Jacquard's loom revolutionized the silk industry. But at its heart was something deeper, something more universal than its industrial origins and its ability to speed up weaving. The loom revealed the power of abstracting information. It showed that you can take the essence of something, extract the vital information, and represent it in another form. Writing had revealed you could use a set of symbols to capture spoken language. Now, Jacquard had shown that with just two symbols, a hole or a blank space, it was possible to capture the information in any picture imaginable. This is a portrait of Jacquard that's been woven in silk. It's spectacularly detailed with hundreds of thousands of stitches, and yet all the information you need to capture this lifelike image can be stored in a series of punched cards, 24,000 of them to be precise. This picture is a fantastic example of a really far-reaching idea. That the simplest of systems, in this case, cards with a series of holes punched in them, can capture the essence of something much, much more complicated.
If 24,000 punch cards could create an image like this, what would happen if you had 24 million? Or 24 trillion cards? What new types of complex information might be able to be captured and represented? Jacquard had stumbled on an incredibly deep and far-reaching idea. As long as you have enough of them, simple symbols can be used to describe anything in the entire universe.
Okay. Now, let's bring this down to home. When I was growing up, I thought that if I fell down and I scraped myself and I lost some skin in the process, that part of me was gone. And every time I did that, irrespective, you might ask a question, why didn't I realize that things healed and looked the same? But at the time, I thought that what had happened was I had irretrievably lost part of myself. But the truth of the matter is, if you think you're made up of matter and that what is you is yours, you're sorely mistaken, because every single atom in your body is exchanges out every 7 years. So 7 years ago, if we were to label the atoms that were in your body and we were to check to see if they're still there today, we would find zero. You say, well, how can that be? I'm still me. I remember 7 years ago. I remember everything that's happened since then. Well, you might say, well, I know the answer to that. Yes, everything in my bones and muscles and things like that exchanges out, but not my brain. Actually, your brain is one of the biggest offenders. Every neuron during its lifespan will exchange out all of its molecules 10,000 times. So if you assume that your neuron's going to live 80 years, that's changing out about every 3 to 4 days. All of them gone. New ones there. So how do you stay you, and how do I stay me? What determines you and what determines me are not the atoms and molecules. We borrow them. We don't own them. They are a vehicle through which we can exist. The only thing that we own is the relationship between those molecules. That's what we own. The pattern. The way those, 120 trillion cells is the latest estimate. It was 100 trillion for quite some time, and then about 10 years ago it was 80 trillion. The number still keeps going up. So let's use 100 trillion. We're going to be in the cutting edge here in these lectures. So we have 120 trillion cells, and each one of those cells is the equivalent, if you wanted to make an analogy, of a city of 50,000 people. It's got its own power stations. It's got its own transportation, it has its own factories, it has its own libraries, it has its hospital, it's got everything. So we have to have 120,000 equivalent towns of 50,000 people, and they all have to have, they have to know where they have to be in their places with bright, shiny faces. They all have to work together, or you aren't you. And I'm not me. What keeps them in order? How do they do that? Well, we're going to get simple so we can get more complex. You're acquainted with Lego blocks. Now, you notice down here they've built a simple little house with a lean-to garage. If you so choose, now, in order to build that, you need the instructions that come in the box. But once you have built that, if you want to change out any of the pieces, you can. They just have to be the same color and the same shape. And they have to go. You have to go back to the pattern and say, oh, yes, this is the number 6X. I need number 6X to make exchange with the other 6X. Let's just suppose you break one. As long as you have the instructions, you can have a whole pile of these Lego blocks, and it doesn't really matter which one you choose. As long as you put it in the right spot, it's still a house with a lean-to. And they have others that have, for instance, a farm yard where you have tractors and everything. Well, you can exchange out every one of those blocks as long as you do it correctly, and it still looks like the farm barnyard. It still works the same. There's no difference. What is the key here? Information. Information in the instruction sheet. So that's, now we're going to go from the simple and we're going to go to the complex. The same is true for you and I. Our instruction sheet is called the genome. And it's the most complex and incredibly powerful information system that we know about anywhere in the universe. Let me give you a quick example. If you take all of the DNA that you have in your body, and you have about six, if you take the DNA and you stretch it out, put it end to end and just stretch it all out, you have about 6 feet worth. If you take the DNA in your body and you stretch it out, end at end, take the DNA out of one cell, put it next to the DNA in the next cell, add them sequentially. When you're through adding them sequentially, you will be able to go from Earth to the Sun, back to the Earth, back to the Sun, back to the Earth, back to the Sun, back to the Earth, and back to the Sun again. And the Sun is 93 million miles away. So that's how much information you're carrying around in you. That should tell you how complicated you are. That's an incredible amount of information. And what type of a system would keep all of this in order and be able to make sense out of it and keep 120 trillion cells in line? If you take all of, let me show you how powerful the system is. If you take all of the libraries in the world, and you can, you can be very loose in your definition of library, and you take all of the information in that library, whether it's media, whether it's printed material, whether it's just graphic pictures, any information that they have, and you converted it into that information into the quaternary code of the DNA, you would have, well, if you, in the entire world, you put all that information and you got it all together in one place, you could put it on the head of a pin very comfortably, because you see you would only be covering one-fourth of the head. And you have, that's nothing. You have enough to go to the Sun back 7 times one direction. This is where the war is being fought between good and evil, and we're in the middle of it. And I know some of you are saying, why are you saying there's a war? I don't see anyone dying in the streets. I don't see bullets flying. I don't see limbs being blown off, unfortunately, like there is in Syria. But Syria is a war on top of a war. Like information systems can be stacked one on top of another. This is a war on top of a war. If you don't think we're in a war, go visit a hospital. Go visit an extended care facility where they're locking people up who have Alzheimer's disease. Go to a graveyard. There are casualties every day. Multiple casualties. People are losing their limbs. They're losing their eyesight. They're losing their mind. You've just gotten used to it. You've just decided that that's the way things normally are. They aren't normally that way. The Bible makes it very clear. This is an aberration. We're in a war. And the strange thing is, most people don't seem to be very concerned about it. And here's the truth. Only two people that I know of have ever escaped this war alive, Enoch and Elijah. Everyone else succumbs to it. Everyone else dies in the end because of this war. Don't you think it's incumbent upon us to find out a little bit about it? Because guess what? We do have a part to play on how this war ends. And I'm going to suggest, well, I'm going to boldly declare to you, here's our description of the war. Here's how it's being played out. Here's our statement of reality that we need to look at, because just by, if this war is taking place at the level of the playing scale, let's say up to 10 angstroms, we have no way of finding out about how this war is going on unless somebody tells us. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to take you through a lot of genetics fast. And I'm sorry, there's only one way to do it. We just need to do it. What I want you to do is do not get tied up in the details. If you get tied up in the details, you're going to say, wait a minute, you were talking about RNA inhibition, and I didn't quite get that. I don't want you to, that's not my purpose. We can't give you a crash course that would take a full year of genetics at a collegiate level. We can't do that this morning, nor should we. What I want you to do is I want you to get a gestalt. I want you to sit there and start realizing the incredible detail of the war that's going on and the two masterminds that are on the two different poles of this war, and we're in the middle. And this war is being fought at such an incredibly complex and such a high level of intellectual functioning that, quite frankly, it's hard for us, even the most brightest minds, to fully comprehend exactly what's going on. We get glimpses of it. But folks, there is as real bullets going on in this war as there is over at Syria. And people, just because you can't see the actual war going on, that just makes it the more lethal. We have to go to the Bible again. It's our only source to tell us about sin and salvation. Science can tell us nothing. I'll keep reiterating that. Why is by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed on all men, for that all have sinned? And we haven't defined sin yet. We'll do that next week. We're going to break it down, just like information theory. We're going to define it, something we can use, and it's portable. We can move it around. So wait till next week on that one. But what is the Bible saying here? It says, nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression. Who is the figure of him that was to come? What Paul is saying here in the second, Romans 5:14, is that whatever Adam and Eve did, it affected all humanity thereafter, even though they didn't do that. Something happened in the garden that was monumental. It was gargantuan. It wasn't simply, I don't want you to eat some of this fruit, but you can eat some of that fruit. And this is, I'm trying to test to see if you're really going to do what I tell you. That was at the very superficial level. Was that involved? Yes, it was. But there were very far more important reasons why that request was made. And we tend to center in on the request itself. And we're missing the far greater information, if I may use that term, pun intended, that we need to glean. That, again, is 2 weeks from now. So I'm not going to belabor that. Okay, here comes the genetics. Take a deep breath in. We're going to go. I'm going to keep it as simple as I can. But what I am doing is, at the end of this talk, I am going to put up a list of references for those of you who may want to download this and go back afterwards. And I beg you to do that, because I'm going to tell you something. Going through it really superficial right now is sort of fun, possibly a little entertaining. But if you really want to get intellectually hyped up, go read some of those papers. It will blow your mind as to what's going on. It's marvelous, entertaining stuff. Barbara McClintock, and around 1948 to 1950, she discovered something in the Cold Springs Harbor Laboratory, which is in New Jersey. She was the only woman at the time who was working as a geneticist there. And she discovered that when corn was stressed, she would stress the plants by not giving them water, that something funny happened to the kernels of the corn. They would turn color. Notice here, the color's bad on this screen, but it's purple and blue and light yellow, and all of these colors all of a sudden popped out. She wondered, why was that when the corn was yellow all the way up till I stressed it? And then after a couple of weeks of stressing, the kernels changed color. And so she went inside and she looked at the genetics and she found that the chromosomes had all changed. They had rearranged. Genes that had been on one chromosome were now on another. Some other genes had, and I'm going to stop here for just a second. I'm using the word gene, and I'm going to, for the purist in the group here, I'm well aware that we're not supposed to use the word gene anymore. We're supposed to use protein coding complex. I'm well aware of that, but I think it's going to be easier for you if I just use the word gene. And the reason is there really isn't. The old concept of a Mendelian gene is now kaput, gone. It's no longer accepted in genetics. It was a good idea while it lasted, just like Newtonian physics got us to general relativity, and I'm guessing general relativity or quantum mechanics is going to have to give between the two of them, so we're going to probably end up with yet another general theory if time goes on. So I'm using the word gene here, but I'm giving you the disclaimer. I'm well aware that I'm using outdated terms. So she looked at these, and she found that the genes had moved around. And she found that genes that hadn't, areas that hadn't been transcribed, that means expressed, before, were now being expressed. And she wondered what in the world was going on. And the more research she did, the more she realized that actually DNA was jumping from one chromosome to another. And she called them controlling elements. She was way ahead of her time, because when she showed it to her male colleagues, they said, oh, that's junk DNA. Or they called it jumping DNA, and they called it silent DNA. And she goes, no, I think it's controlling elements. And they said, go back to the back desk, and don't worry your pretty little head about these things. We've got this now. We know what we're doing. Well, she got a Nobel Prize in 1983 because she persisted, and she had discovered upon, in my opinion, one of the biggest discoveries in genetics ever. What she found was that these mobile, she called them mobile genetic, we're going to call them mobile transposable elements, but they're really mobile genetic elements. And everyone had always thought that DNA was static. You know, there it is, double helix, written in stone. And here she found out that it was not true. It's a dynamic, almost a living organism on its own, exchanging information amongst itself. And what we have found out since then is it's beyond complex. But these controlling elements were exactly that. They were these transposable elements were controlling elements. And as around 1995 and thereafter, especially at 2000, people began to really realize what she had found. And actually, our evolutionist friends are now frolicking in the data of transposable elements, because single nucleotide polymorphisms, that's SNP or otherwise known as a mutation, cannot explain evolution on a genetic basis. They all know it. It's the old idea that you could get changes in the code and then the environment would come in and select out the more, if it was an advantageous change, is gone, because the SMPs almost, well, there's never been an SMP yet that they found that's been advantageous to the information system. They've all come with some significant baggage, and I'm well aware of things like sickle cell anemia and things of that nature. They have very heavy baggage that comes with them, so you can argue whether they're really helpful or not. Okay, genomes were forged by massive bombardments with retro elements and retro segments, sequences. What they're saying here, and this paper eloquently points out, that actually our information system, which is our DNA system, our genome system, has been entirely created by these retro elements. Repetitive elements comprise over two-thirds of the human genome. Now, let me put this another way to you. Two-thirds of the DNA in me and two-thirds of the DNA in you were not in the original equipment. They've been added since the original genome was made, whether you want to argue it's evolution or creation. We're creationists here, so I'm going to go ahead and I've already told you I assume that Genesis 1 through 11 is factual and literal. So we're going to go with, since I can call the assumptions, I'm going to do that. So let's go with the creation part. Adam and Eve, if we had the opportunity to take a look at their genome, we would find that two-thirds of the information we have in ours is absent from theirs. But that's not the only problem. Because a large amount of unspecified large amount of DNA that we would find in their genome is missing from ours. And I'll show you shortly how we know that. Okay, let's take a look at these mobile genetic elements. And we could spend an hour, a thrilling, captivating hour discussing them, but I will refrain and try to keep it to a bare minimum and just show you topographically the main stuff, okay? At the very top is a DNA transposon. That means that this guy is made out of DNA. All of the others are made out of RNA. So this is the only DNA, and the first attack on the human genome came with the DNA transposons. And there's an important reason why. We have something in our cells called theta defensins, which will wipe out free RNA in the nucleus. And so something had to come in and take them out, the theta defensins. And how do we know that? Because you see, HIV is a retrovirus. That means it's an RNA virus. And we found that a number of years ago that about 5% of the population, or a little bit less, seems to be immune to catching the virus. And so people thought, well, it's something magic in their blood. What is it? And when they really looked into it, what they found is that you and I have a transposable element that's knocked out our capability of making a theta defensin. But these people in the 5%, the mobile genetic element that's causing 95% of the population's theta defensin not to work has dropped out because they're mobile. So it's exited the area, and now they're capable of making this theta defensin, which is a special chemical which will wipe out retroviruses or RNA viruses that come in. So we know that at one point in time, humanity, all of us had the ability to stop these retroviruses, and now less than 5% of us do, and the only reason those 5% do is because one of these transposable elements that was in their genome stopping it jumped out and is no longer holding back that part of the genome from being expressed. We get into the garden, that's going to get important. Now, those were the first guys to come in, and they're like an intercontinental ballistic missile with multiple warheads. We're talking information here, so when I say multiple warheads, we're talking about multiple warheads carrying new information into the genome. The second group, it says retroposons, and it says the word autonomous because these guys, one of them represent viruses, and the other one represents the long retroposons. And you don't need to know these names, it's just to tell you that both viruses and these, and it's called endogenous retroviruses, or you may have heard the word HERVs, human endogenous retroviruses. They fall into this class along with something else called the retrotransposons, which are, both of them are made out of RNA, and what happens is they get into the cell and they carry all of the information so that they can make their own enzymes so that they can take the RNA and make it a template to make DNA. And once that DNA is made, they then have special enzymes that make a surgical incision into your DNA and mine and embed it. And it becomes part of your record. Now, the top guys, when they came in, they're called cut and paste. They would come in and they would put themselves into part of the genome and they'd knock out a section of the genome and it's lost. So that's right there is our first evidence that we know that we lost DNA because we know how these guys work, and we've got a lot of them in our DNA. So wherever they are, they've displaced information that used to be there. These retroposons, they do copy and paste. So what happens is they can be one area in genomes, in chromosome, say, 10, and it can be copied, and they multiple copies can go out, and they can jump over to chromosome 21, chromosome 11, chromosome 2. And that's what they do. They move around. The body tries to find out where they are and tries, we're going to find out in a minute, tries to eliminate them, and these guys keep moving. They keep moving. Now, the bottom ones, they're very interesting. They're, you notice the word non-autonomous. They don't carry the enzyme, the information for the enzymes that they need to do this very ingenious way of taking over, of placing themselves into the cell's DNA. They use the enzymes that are made by the autonomous transposons. They use those because somehow they, teleologically speaking, they already know that those enzymes are there. They're already being made by their earlier buddies, and all they have to do is now they're a much smaller, more accurate weapon. The middle group here is much like if you have a stealth bomber and you come in and it's got laser-guided bombs. The last group down here, these are cruise missiles. They go specifically to certain genes. They can go through the 3 billion base pairs and they can find exactly the protein coding area that they're looking for. That's how sharp and how well they are honed to go do what they have to do. And then when they get there, they change the information. Now, here's a quandary I want you to think about, because the scientists have been thinking about it for some time and they don't have an answer. And that is, these guys, well, the DNA transposons for certain, but viruses and these retrotransposons, they claim, if you look at the geological column, you can find them 100 feet down in the Precambrian layer. They predate any cell. So now here's the question. How could a perfectly engineered parasite be waiting for cells to evolve and life to occur so that they can then come in and take over that cell? You have to have two separate evolutions, but the first evolution has to go hand in glove with the second and be perfectly engineered to go in and do the job it's going to do. And if I get my act together and get moving here, you'll find we're going to find out that cells have over 50 different roadblocks that we know of for a virus to come in and try to take over the cell. So they had to have evolved with that capability when the first cell arrived. They needed to have that ready to go. Fitness cost. Line one, those were the retro transposons, the autonomous ones. They're long. They're many, many base pairs long. This is from Stanford. It's an NIH-sponsored piece of research. It says, in conclusion, our results indicate this FLTA1 is a line-1 retroposon. That's its family's name, and then these guys are, there's over 400 different families and counting, and they've got a tree of life, if you will, for these retroposons because they branch out and there's so many different ones and they do so many different things. We also found that TA1 elements have become more deleterious as the expansion of the TA1 family proceeded. Understanding what makes these transposable elements deleterious and how they affect fitness requires a greater understanding of how these genomic parasites, their word, not mine, affect the human genome. In any event, because these retroposons, amplification is ongoing. That means they are increasing in number. They are trying to take over your genome, and eventually they will, and you'll die. That's how we know I'm going to die and you're going to die, unless something big happens in the fairly near future. There's no getting around this. They are going to win. You cannot beat it. In any event, the amplification is ongoing. It seems likely that the genetic fitness of present humans continues to be reduced. It's another way of saying these guys are dragging humanity down. What does our genome encode? If you want to go out and get something that's really interesting to read that would synopsize a lot of what we know about the genome right now, the ENCODE project, which was published in 2012, would be a good place to start, because what they found was that, let me read it here. It is widely assumed that roughly half of the human genome sequence has been laid waste, his words, their words, not mine, by transposable elements and other classes of repetitive sequences, which have repeatedly and haphazardly pummeled the genome at various evolutionary intervals. These regions were all but invisible during the ENCODE pilot phase, where they were intentionally masked from microarray designs. But the situation changed dramatically with sequence tag-based assays. What he's talking about is when they first looked at it, trying to see how much of the human genome is transcribed, that means read and taken out to the cell as information, they missed all of this stuff. When they changed and they went to another technique to look at it, bam, there it was. It was like looking in invisible light and then looking with an infrared camera. All of a sudden, something you didn't see before now is readily there. Even modest lengths have potential to align uniquely with over 85% of the genome sequence and thus to annotate a majority of transposable elements. So what they're saying here is actually these transposable elements, these additions, these guys that have come along and invaded your information system and set up housekeeping, may be as much as 85% of your DNA. In marked contrast to the prevailing wisdom, ENCODE, chromatin, and transcription studies now suggest that a large number of transposable elements encode highly cell-type-specific regulatory DNA that controls not only their own cell-selective transcription, but also those of neighboring genes. Far from an evolutionary dustbin, transposable elements appear to be active and lively members of the genomic regulatory community, deserving of the same level of scrutiny applied to other genetic regulatory features. These transposable elements, let me translate it, they've taken over yours and my genome and they're running the show. You used to think that all of this junk DNA and silent DNA was worthless, that it was evolutionary remnants of past codes that are no longer needed and are now defunct and therefore are in the trash heap. Just the cell hadn't got rid of them yet. And that changed, because what happened next is they said, actually, these guys are all transcribed. They found that over 80%, and they suggested in the article that it's going to be closer to 100% of the genome is transcribed, which means it's all read. It's all dictating constantly to the cell, all of it. There is no part of the genome that's an old relic of past evolution. Everything that's there now is being used. I just wanted to read one other. This is from proceedings from the National Academy of Sciences. It says, by constantly challenging the integrity of our genome, the product of line, remember lines dash one, that's what they're referring to, they're called long interspersed nuclear elements, retrotransposition create a tremendous amount of ongoing genomic fluidity and instability. That's not good. If you're looking for a compliment there, don't. All of it's bad. Thereby durably putting the human genome in the line of fire. Here's what they call these guys. They call them selfish genetic elements. Genetic conflict and evolutionary innovation. This is from, it's 2011. Rapidly growing evidence emerging from genomics and advances in genetics indicate that selfish genetic elements are important motors for evolutionary change and innovation. Several general principles have reoccurred in the discussion above, and I will briefly revisit these themes here. The first is that selfish genetic elements lead to antagonistic coevolution. Fancy term, they fight against you, and your cell fights against them, and one of you has to change, and both of you start, your information systems try to adapt to the other. But in the end, of course, the transposal elements are going to win. But in the process, they say, the good outcome for humanity is it's forced, for instance, it's forced us to develop a big cerebrum. Because, you see, we were trying to outfox them. And anyway, the idea is that it's what, this is the new motor for evolution. This is the new driving force that they are now looking at. The old mutations is dead and gone. Important features of eukaryote genomes: DNA methylation, RNA inhibition, small RNA regulatory pathways, and restrictive modification systems have evolved, at least in part, as defense mechanisms against selfish genetic elements. I like the way, you know, this is a Balaam moment. I love the way this guy is called them by their true term, because what they do is they come in and at the expense of the cell, they start multiplying. And they start shutting down things in the cell they don't like. And they start trying to accrue more and more mass numbers, and eventually they do win. The hard part the bad part is they end up killing their host in the process. But their job is to do one thing: take over your information system. And Jesus knew their thoughts and said unto them, every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself shall not stand. Evolutionists are trying to say, well, this was good conflict because it forced new life forms, which then the environment was able to select. I disagree. I think that this Christ is right. No one can... Why did I put this text in? Because there's no way, after reading what I have, but in case there's any inkling of thoughts in any of you, well, maybe God created these. What did Christ say? If you have two systems fighting against each other, that's not good. It won't stand. I do not give my... I do not find that a positive thing. S signs were the bottom group. Remember the non-autonomous, the cruise missiles. And I just put a paper up here as a reference. It says that the non-coding signs depend on reverse transcriptase and endonuclease functions encoded by their partner lines. So, you know, if one didn't know better, you'd think that this was a very well-planned attack against the human genome. Just like when we went into Iraq, or the first time, remember, with Bush Sr., and what was the first thing we did? We knocked out their anti-aircraft defenses, we knocked out their radar, and then we knocked out their communication systems. Remember that? And in order, we took them down. If you were going to attack the genome, if someone was going to attack the genome, that's exactly what's happened. If you had a brilliant mind coming in to try to take over the human genome, it happened. Now, the scientists who wrote these papers would say this was luck, fortuitous, 3.5 billion years of trial and error. But it is so well engineered. Somebody had to know a lot about what was going on in the information system, or they never could have gotten in. Much less completely rewrote the instructions for you and me. This is from Craig Venter. He's the guy that, along with Francis Collins, were credited with mapping the human genome. I think it was in 2003 they came out with this, and they made a big joint statement that they had mapped the human genome. In reality, we're finding out that the first maps were hastily brought to press. Significant portions of them were inaccurate, and as we're going to find out here in a moment, if I can get going, the human genome changes, it's dynamic. So if we mapped you today and looked at you tomorrow or next week, it would be different. And here's a real bell ringer. Oh, wait, that's next week. I'm going to save that for next week. I'll just give you a hint. We have multiple genomes in our body. We don't just have one. That's for next week. It's a teaser. The density of the T's in the human chromatin, this is chromosome 22 and chromosome 2. If you look at the blue, those are exons, is another way of saying a protein coding area. So those are areas that are relatively free of these mobile genetic elements, okay? And look at the red. The red are transposable elements. Look at the ratio. And remember, the blue are like piano keys. The protein coding areas, they're like piano keys. Every protein coding area can make up to 400 different proteins. And so they're like the piano keys. What tells the piano key what to play, have you seen these player pianos where they have a drum and they put it on the player piano and they start the drum and it will play Mozart and everyone is listening and then someone goes gets a different drum and puts it on and it plays honky tonk? Same piano keys, right? Well, the piano keys in this analogy are the blue. The red are the drums that come in and they play the different tunes. And the original tune we can't even find. We don't know. It's gone. But the tune that's playing now is not Mozart. It's more on the area of honky tonk if you're going to compare them as far as musicality. Are you starting to get a picture? And just real quickly, the Hox-D cluster, that's what determines our body shape. So that's why, notice there isn't any red there. I mean, that's why we still have two arms and two legs and two eyes and a nose. Those Hox areas are what keep us so that our arms are relatively the same length and our feet are, our legs are relatively same length. For some reason, transposable elements can't get in there. Real quickly, pseudogenes. What are pseudogenes? They're about 1.5% of your genome, and my genome codes for protein, and that's an ongoing thing. About 8% of our genome is genes that were probably once there, but have been coming in, have transposable elements have come in and ravaged them. They've rewritten them. They've moved them around. They've made copy number variation. They've made multiple copies of the same gene, which ends up to be a major cause of a lot of diseases, genetic diseases. I'm not going to take the time now to talk about. We're going to talk about diseases more next week. Look at how many pseudogenes there are. They outnumber the real genes, the original equipment, by at least 4 to 1. And we don't know exactly what all these guys originally did. We just know that they have been so changed by transposable elements that many of them don't work anymore. But some of them still do. And what they do is very mischievous. Lest you think we're going to find a silver lining to this cloud, there isn't one. All careful studies of mutagenesis find statistically significant non-random patterns of change. What this is saying is these guys have been if you didn't know better, you'd think they were programmed because 80% of the transposable elements are lined up around protein coding areas that code for protein for the central nervous system. And if you do this by statistical, by chance, in other words, they said, well, I know what happened. It was just like a shotgun blast of shrapnel at our genome. And it should be in a statistical Gaussian curve about where all of this stuff goes. It's not. 80%. There's no curve here at all. 80% goes around areas that code for the hardware in our brain. And that's a problem. And how did they know to go there? Why wasn't it chance? Why didn't it just come from like a shot out of a cannon? Transposal elements are found in a large number of human protein coding genes. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but you know the meager 1.5% that we still have that we're counting on to keep us going? A significant number of those have been invaded. In the middle of the gene, it's called an intron. And what they have done is they've told that gene, that the messenger RNA that comes off of it, they have coded it so that it will go do different things than originally planned by that protein coding sequence. So not to worry, we have a 1.5%. Well, it's not really 1.5%. Are you starting to get the picture? We've been hijacked big time. These guys are active from birth until death. They're the most active at birth. They make sure that new fetus is going to be absolutely programmed the way they want it to be. They are wildly active. And part of the reason they're wildly active is because that baby is making new cells as fast as it can. And during that replicative mitosis part of things is when these guys can get out and romp and play. If they could play unrestricted, we'd be dead. The fetus would never get past, wouldn't even get past a blastocele. They've done this. They've knocked it out in mice. And by the way, mice have way fewer per capita or per nucleotide, transposable elements than we do. If you knock out the restrictions on their transposable elements, none of them get to the embryo stage. They die off at the blastocele stage. These guys are lethal. Promoters are kind of like the ignition, the brake, and the accelerator pedal to a gene. So if you want to get that gene, that protein coding area, to do something for you, you need a promoter. And the gas pedal means you're going to make more copies. Brake means you're going to make fewer copies. And the ignition means you're going to turn the gene on. Or you're going to turn the gene off with the ignition. Well, guess what? In this paper, which was in 2009, 75% of human genes use alternate promoters, and those promoters have come in from with transposable elements. If you own the promoter, you own the gene. And here is, and time has got me, and I knew it would. I just wanted to point out, I'm just going to glaze over this. You can see this, the top of this paper here. It says the gross deletions involving, and it gives you a number of transposable elements. There's been a lot of deletion from the genome that Adam and Eve would have had to what we have. We don't know how much, and we don't know what was lost. But without a doubt, there is a marked difference in capabilities between the two. And obviously, they have them and we don't. Remember I said the part of the piano player piano, the drum part that runs the piano keys? Those are called non-coding RNA sections that get transcribed off. And it's way beyond the level of this class to explain how it happens. But it's very, you can map it out. It's very understandable. It's very cause and effect. And what you'll find out is that transposable elements are the major contributors to the origin, diversification, and regulation of vertebrae long-coding RNAs, which means, again, I'm coming every which way in on this subject to tell you that what is determining what is being transcribed off of your DNA, by and large, was added. And here's another paper just to, and if you want to download this later, you can get the sources. Next week, we're going to go into the human brain and what it's done in the human brain. And that is fascinating. And in fact, we aren't going to get out of the brain much for the next 8 lectures. And that includes when Christ comes and what he does. And that includes when we talk about especially what happened on the cross. And it also will include what lecture 10, which is what happens to those who turn God down on his gracious offer of salvation. So we're going to spend some time next week because we really need to get our sea legs and know what's going on there. I told you 80% of these transposable elements go around the protein, the coding areas for the brain. So wouldn't you assume, therefore, that they probably have their biggest influence there also? It just seems to be common sense, and in fact, that's true. Now, real quickly, I'm going to talk about the cells fight back. I'm going to just cover some stuff briefly here because when we get into the Holy Spirit and we get into salvation, we'll be talking about this with a little more depth. Transposable elements are major components of the intergenetic regions of the genome. However, transposable element transposition has the potential to threaten the reproductive fitness of the organism. Therefore, organisms have evolved specialized molecular systems to sense and repress the expression of the transposable elements to stop them from jumping to other genomic loci. Emerging evidence suggests that argonaut proteins play a critical role in this process in collaboration with two types of cellular small RNAs, PIWI interacting RNAs and of the germline, and endogenous small interfering RNAs, endo silencing RNAs of the soma, both which are transcribed from TEs themselves. Real briefly, somehow the body, in your nucleus, you have systems that can go up, and when these transposable elements are exposed, when the cell is dividing in mitosis, the transposable elements quickly put out messenger RNA, because that messenger RNA is going to do a lot of mischievous things we'll talk about next week. Some smart proteins in your body capture those messenger RNAs, and they cut them down to about 19 to 23 nucleotides long. They then attach them to something called an argonaut protein, which goes hunting on the DNA to find out where that sequence came from, and when it finds it, it either methylates it or it destroys it. You start getting an idea about the war, the information war that's going on here. This is just the first salvo. We don't have time. I mismanaged it, and I apologize. Are transposable elements simply silenced, or are they under house arrest? Well, the answer to that question is both. But how does that occur? Retroposons is a major source of epigenetic variation in the mammalian genome. Now, we haven't even started talking about epigenetics, and epigenetics is, we could do 10 lectures on that. Easy. Let me just try to boil this down real briefly for you. Right now, there's a lot of nurture versus nature arguments. There has been all along. And the idea, people kind of settle the fight by saying, well, it's 50% and 50%. 50% nurture, 50% nature. Nature being DNA, nurture being environment. Well, as time goes on, we're finding out it's actually more like 80-20%. 80% environment, 20% DNA. So people are saying, see, it really has nothing to do with DNA. It really has to do with your environment. But what they miss is the information system that codes these proteins that it makes them capable of responding to the environment is the key. If your information system didn't so program and so construct these proteins so that they would respond to the environment, they wouldn't. At the end of the day, as FDR said, the buck stops here. The buck's got to stop in the information system because it's the one that codes in this ability to have multiple responses to different environmental stimuli. You could go back in there if you knew enough, and you could redo the code, and it wouldn't respond to environmental stimuli. So it's still king of the roost. Heterochromatin. We're almost there. We're on the home stretch now. Stay with me. We can do it. I'm going to show you a picture of heterochromatin in a moment so you can see what I'm talking about. So just try to get the information here. It says heterochromatin formation and maintenance integrate diverse kinds of information, including chromosomal location, nuclear localization, and the presence and density of repetitive DNA elements. See those? Oh, they're popping up again. The chromosomal regions that contain a high density of repetitive DNA, when they say repetitive DNA, you're talking transposons. Or retrotransposons in this case. the foreigners, the invaders, the new stuff. The repetitive DNA elements, such as clusters of satellite sequences and transposable elements, which are found at centromeres, telomeres, and knobs, are the main targets of heterochromatin formation. These regions remain condensed through the cell cycle and are referred to as constitutive heterochromatin. What this is saying is another way the cell tries to deal with these, if there's a segment that is wildly infected with transposable elements, and I'm using that term specifically, that's a scientific term in dealing with this, because they call them parasites, selfish genetic elements, the whole works. What the cell does is it says, okay, we cannot afford to have this around. It's going to take over. It's going to kill us. So they wrap it up in proteins called histones, and they lock it up tight. So you can't get in there. There's no way that any of the enzymes that are needed to have transcription can get in there and get to the code. It's locked up. It's put into a chest, and it's thrown into the ocean, so to speak. It can be drawn back up. It's not gone, but it's inoperable. Heterochromatin formation protects genomic integrity by rendering repetitive structures recombinationally inert and prohibiting potential mutagenic transposition events. In other words, it keeps them right where they are, and it doesn't allow them to get into any mischief, and it doesn't allow them to be transcribed. It's, in essence, putting them in timeout in the corner, and there's no way for them to get out and do anything. And if you see this picture, notice where it says nuclear pore? That's the nuclear membrane goes right up there and continues up around. So that's the nuclear membrane. That's the covering of your nucleus where your most of your DNA is housed. The pores let things in and out, and they've got fascinating. There's sentinels there at that pore, at that opening, that actually check the credentials of everything that comes in and goes out. It checks all the proteins that come in so only the right ones can come in. It's kind of like having a card, and they have to put the card in before they're allowed in. You want to talk about a system upon system upon system of checks and balances. This genome is, I've just not even scratched the top of it. The amount of interaction between the different elements that deal with your genome are phenomenal. You see this where it says euchromatin, it's sort of light, and you notice up there at the top it says heterochromatin, and it looks kind of like a berry bush. Well, that's all that DNA that's been wrapped up in protein and locked down so that nothing can happen to it. And down here, where it's more open and you don't see that, what looks like maybe dirt on the screen, is where transcription is going on 24/7. That's where both protein coding areas and non-protein coding areas are firing out stuff in blinding speed. So you can see that heterochromatin, it looks like what it is. It's densely condensed DNA information that's rendered inoperative. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and thou sewest up my iniquity, Job 14:17. The iniquity of Ephraim is bound up, his sin is hid. I'm going to already tell you next week, one of our definitions is iniquity equals transposable elements. So in the Bible, in this paradigm, when you are reading the Bible and you read iniquity, you can substitute transposable elements. I've gone through the Bible and done it, and it works for me. But this is my bias, of course. And I can't prove that. I want to make one other disclaimer. I have to do it every lecture, and I forgot to do it this one. I cannot prove anything that I'm telling you today as far as how it relates with the Bible, because you see, the Bible doesn't index these journal articles. I cannot prove to you today that what I'm showing you is what the Bible is talking about, because I wasn't there in the Garden of Eden. I didn't get a chance to look at Adam and Eve's genome, and I certainly haven't had a chance to see how this information war has progressed over the last 6,000 or 7,000 years. So this is an educated guess. He that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth. I probably don't have to tell you that the mobile genetic elements don't like being all bound up in the heterochromatin, and they do everything they can to get out. I'm sure that came as a shock to you. And that's one part of the war, is trying to keep them locked up and them trying to get out. And I'm just going to throw in this paradigm that I'm presenting to you, we have the keys as to whether they get out or not. That's where we come into this. But that's down three lectures, so let's move on. Almost there. Genomic imprinting, the emergence of an epigenetic pattern. Okay, if you take what they found out, is scientists, is when they looked at these heterochromatin, what they found was that this was not wildly variable between the cells within a single individual. And they began to realize that there was certain genetic information that was present, and it so happened to be that they found it in the fathers, but that is present, we think it's in the female line too, that determines how, where this stuff is and how it's to be bound up so that the new offspring aren't overwhelmed by it. And therefore, there's a select pattern. The cell somehow, teleologically speaking, knows. The parents, in other words, the parents pass on to the offspring the knowledge of that they've got to lock up this section of DNA. There's many sections of DNA. Otherwise, the offspring wouldn't know. But somehow, this information comes through, and it comes through the woman's egg, and we're going to be talking about when we get to what happened in the garden and the quote-unquote curses that came afterwards. Really, they're just talking straight genetics, in my opinion. But what happens is these patterns of making heterochromatin are inherited. And they're inherited for approximately 4 to 5 generations. So if you get a real bad infection, that's the male up there, the square is a male and you have the red dot, you get a real, that male, and let's just for argument's sake, because you know what I'm sure you know where this paradigm is going. I've already told you that you can determine what gets released and what doesn't to a large degree. You're doing something that's working with the enemy. You're going to get more mobile genetic elements. They're going to start multiplying. And maybe some of them are going to be let out of their time out in the corner. This could become dangerous to the life of the individual. But more importantly, it could become very dangerous to their offspring. But what they find is the first level of offspring, you don't see any symptoms. I should back up. The father makes heterochromatin out of the area where all of this was transpiring. He binds it up. His system binds it up so that it will not destroy him. He passes that information unaltered onto his children, and they're able to bind it up too. But thereafter, even though the information is passed on to the further children, that binding up now starts to have a cost because, you see, good, I'm going to use the quotes around good, good DNA is also bound up with the bad. The body can't differentiate and say, okay, we're just going to bind up here, we're going to leave this part, and then we're going to bind up here. It just starts and goes from A to Z all the way down that infected area, and it locks it all up and sends it away to the heap. And the trouble is, good, I'm using again, teleologically speaking, good DNA is covered up, and therefore it can end up as a disease, or it can end up as anxiety syndrome, or it can end up on a number of other areas, and I'm just throwing these out as examples. I don't have a paper that proves either one of those, but I do have other circumstantial evidence that we're going to get to in the next 2 weeks that would imply that that happens. Because you understand, science is not thinking along the lines that we are, so they're not going to do experiments just for us. At the end of 4 generations, this sequestering, this information that's passed on and how to make this heterochromatin disappears. Don't know why. It's gone. And so my thinking is, and I have not been able to find any papers to back this up, but the transmoldable elements are highly mutagenic, meaning they can undergo mutation very easily. And so after five generations, most of these guys have already had enough mutations that they aren't going to be effective anymore. And what happens then is that releases back to the generations 5, 6, and 7 the good information that was covered up because of what Daddy did up here. Keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty. Visiting the iniquity, let's put in transposable elements, humor me. Visiting the transposable elements of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and fourth generation. And if you count it from Dad back there, there's four generations after him. I can't prove that that's what the Bible is talking about, but it just seems to fit. Viruses, they're mutated sons of TEs. The big thing to know of them is viruses carry around enzymes and code that you find nowhere else in any other living organisms anywhere. And they're called hallmark genes because they have proteins. The proteins that they make do very bad things for your cell. So there would be no reason for your cell to code from. But then the major question comes, where did those guys get those genes from? If it's not found anywhere in any of God's creation, how did they get there? And how were they there before the first living cell came on the scene? Talk to the evolutionists, they agree it's a problem. And they will also tell you they may never have an answer to it. That's how big of a problem it is. Viruses make us. I don't have time to go through this. I want to change your views on virus. Here's a. This is a Pandora virus, and it has about 2,500 protein coding areas or genes. You and I have around 21,500. So you see, this one virus can carry 10% of the protein coding information that you and I have now. So don't think this is horizontal. Information transfer. These viruses, this one happens to infect plants. That's lucky for us. But the amount of information that's being exchanged in this room, while I'm talking to you, you have inhaled 100,000 new viruses and you've inhaled 30,000 bacteria. And no, not all of it came from me, even though I'm up here bloviating. It just came from everyone else that walked in the room, too. We're under siege. It's everywhere. And what I wanted to do today was give you a little idea that what the scientists are telling us is that actually we are the product of viruses, and that viruses cultivate us just like we do fruit trees and wheat and everything else. We think we're the ones here that are running the show, but they are. And we're here and at their good because of their good graces. And that they keep us alive long enough to continue to mutate, and when we're no longer useful, they kill us off. There is actually that proposal out there because there is so much of the information in our biome is of this type that it dwarfs the amount that isn't. This is the last major thing I'm going to tell you about, and this is going to come as a surprise to you, and I want you to bear with me on this one. You know, why don't we just get rid of these guys? If they're that bad for the human genome, why haven't we jettisoned them by now? The simple answer is because we can't. Viruses can, we now focus on the forces that compel viruses along with the defective versions of information to persist in host populations and why this can affect population-based identity and survival. That's, he just said what I told you a moment ago. Viruses can persist via the action of addiction modules. As mentioned, this was first seen with a P1 phage, which would induce post-segregation killing of the host lost if the host lost the virus. Basically, the virus will stabilize its persistence by expressing a stable toxic gene, but prevent destruction by also expressing a less stable antitoxic gene. And I'll explain this in a minute. Any environmental alteration in the dynamic, either the loss of viral DNA or infection with other agents, will often affect the protective component of the addiction molecule, resulting in the destruction of the host. What these viruses have done is they've come in and they've set up, they brought in the information to make a protein that's lethal to your cell. But the reason when that protein is expressed, it doesn't kill off the cell, is they also have another protein coding area that makes an antidote to the first protein. So it comes in and it locks in on the first protein and keeps it from acting. Now, if you come in and you say the cell finds a way to get rid of this virus, what happens is, without the virus there constantly telling the protector protein to make the protector protein, it won't. And that then leaves the lethal poison that was made with the first gene free to act, and the cell is killed. You can't get rid of it without causing the death of the cell. This is a real war. How is God going to get out from under this? How is He going to get us out from this mess? Think about that. That's a poison pill. The poison pill is in the system. The virus has the antidote. You take away the virus, it doesn't make that antidote anymore, and the poison pill kills the host. They shall see thee narrowly. They shall narrowly look upon thee and consider thee, saying, is this the man that made the earth to tremble, that did shake kingdoms, that made the world as a wilderness, and destroyed the cities thereof, that opened not the house of his prisoners? I just described to you a prison situation. And he didn't code in any way for you to get an eye to get out. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound. I bet that text has a new meaning to you now, doesn't it? Sure does to me. This is just a little slide to tell you that once you get a virus infection, if it gets into your germline, you're going to pass it on to your progeny, and it's going to become part of their DNA. And then they have actually found a circumstantial evidence that this may be the source of things like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, multiple sclerosis, and a lot of the autoimmune diseases. It's not for sure yet. It's at this point correlative, so don't bank on it, but I'm just telling you they can have some very deleterious reactions. Why is by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed on all men, for that all have sinned? Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned, after the multitude of Adam's transgression, who was the figure of what was to come. I'm not going to go into genetic engineering, just to tell you, we use the transposons now to do all of our genetic engineering. You can actually order them commercially, and you can order specific ones to knock out specific genes in specific mammals. They're that accurate. You can go after one protein coding area of maybe 2,000 base pairs in a human genome of 3 billion, and it'll find it. And it will bring in other genetic information, and it will insert it. These are not shotgun blasts. These things are cruise missiles. They have been very well programmed by a very brilliant mind somewhere. recapitulating. How do T's affect the genome? They hijack it in a number of ways. They make duplicate copies. They stop or start certain genes' transcriptions. They initiate nonsense transcription, cause breakage in chromosomes. That's a big one. Move genes and non-coding base pairs to other areas of the genome and or cause them to be deleted altogether. Flip genes, insert themselves. That's how you get pseudogenes. Remember, we talked about those earlier. And they hijack control of the genes totally. And I'm putting this paper up for those of you who want to get references for all of this. There they are. You can go home and download them and see it and for yourself. Here's the results. This is what we're talking about next week. Just do a quick mental check. Are these the things you'd kind of expect when you say the word sin to be causing? Or am I missing the boat here? Because that's what these guys do. This is my last two slides. Another parable he put forth of them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the grain had sprouted and produced a crop, then the tares also appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, 'Sir, did you not sow good seed in the field? How then does it have tares?' He said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' The servant said to him, 'Do you want us to then go and gather them up?' But he said, 'No, lest while you gather up the tares, you root up also the wheat with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather you together first the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" I've just given you the next 8 weeks right there. Each one of those sentences is pregnant with, I believe, genomic information. Mercifully, we're done. So do you dare ask any questions, or have I sufficiently confused you so that everyone is added for the door? I wouldn't blame you. I told you this was going to be tough. I told you this was the worst lecture.
If you were to put it into one sentence, how would you describe this talk?
This talk? The human genome has been horribly hijacked.
Genetic disease.
Now you're at, I'm going to say this for the mic. How do other people who see this information not come up with a conclusion that this was unlikely to have occurred by chance? Is that doing it fair? Go ahead.
If you don't have the right guidebook, you're floundering unless you have a guidebook to help explain. Sadly, some of our church seems to think there isn't an adversary, although Christ says there is. But when you understand this battle that's going on in the cell with the proper guidebook guiding you, everything makes perfect sense. So that's why I think they're floundering with this.
Does that make sense?
Once you've started down the evolutionary path, I've said this last week, I'll probably say it every week, so forgive me. I don't think evolution would have taken off if Darwin had come around today with the idea, because people would have said there's no way with all of this intricate information processing in a cell, that just couldn't happen. But once you've started down the road early on, when they looked at cells and thought they were just cytoplasmic goo, and that they just did the basic rudimentary things, and actually they don't. You're going to find out in the next couple of weeks, these cells are marvelous. They are incredibly engineered units. And so once you get going on this route, it's hard to make a U-turn and go back, especially if you are immediately stripped of tenure and anything, in any position you will have in any institution if you do anything other than reductionism and materialism, reductionary materialism. If you don't follow that code, you're gone. You know, you're no more employment. Well, they don't see it as a saving face. They see it as keeping out the myth that there's a God. And by the way, I want to say one other thing. The most brilliant move the adversary ever made was to convince people he didn't exist. Because you see, now when you look at this, you go, well, where could they have come from? I don't know. There's no devil. So God, would God have created this in his own system? That doesn't make sense either. Maybe evolution's the answer. I don't know. Maybe it was a hodgepodge. And, you know, 3.5 billion years, we weren't there. We're here, aren't we? That's the argument they like to use when you get them into a straight corner, straight into a straight place. But they can get us into straight places, too. So let me be clear about that. We both have holes in our theories. So I'm not here. I have very good friends who are very much evolutionary minded. And they're very smart people. So I'm in no way denigrating them. The Bible's the only setting that lets you know that there is a war going on. And now, when you know there's a war going on, all of these things, at least to me, make sense. And what we're going to talk about next week, we're just going to, like peeling the onion, we're going to take the next layer off. We're going to go into the brain. And you're going to be surprised with what we find. I certainly was. And then we have to go into what it's done to the biome. That's the fourth week. And then the fifth week is, what is God going to do about it? So we've first five lectures is what went wrong. The last five lectures are, how is it fixed? And as horrifically complex and absolutely malignant in design as you've just seen a brief overview today, God's answer is just magnitudes more brilliant. Absolutely, in a chess game, he has pulled off the incredible moves. And if you weren't thankful before, come and hear what these have got to say. You're going to say, this is incredible what he did. I can't believe he did this. What a brilliant move. Who would have ever thought? Okay, I promised Pastor Carl I'd get you out of here by 11:30, and he's going to pull my credentials if I'm... So we'll see you here next week, same time, same station, and I promise you easier fare next week.